The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Culture Map presents What's Eric Eating? From the Gal Media Studios in Houston, Texas, here's Culture Map food editor Eric Sandler.
Welcome to What's Eric Eating? Culture Map's weekly look at all things Houston bars and restaurants. I'm your host, Culture Map food editor Eric Sandler. I have Michael Sandbrooks and Steve Breaker from Sandbrooks Management Company coming up in a little bit. But first, I am joined by two co-hosts this week. As you may have noticed, I was off last week. I spent a couple of days on jury duty, which prohibited me from recording this podcast in a timely way. So last week's co-host and this week's co-host are both on the show this week. Let me start with, he is a frequent, he is a passionate advocate for the Houston food scene and a frequent traveler, Matt Harris. Welcome back to the show. How are you?
Doing well, sir. Good to be here.
Thanks for being here. She's the owner of Fluff Bake Bar in Midtown, Rebecca Masson. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Eric.
Becky, thanks for being here. Let us dive right into the news of the week. Topic number one, Loro, the Asian smokehouse that is owned by Tyson Cole of Uchi and Aaron Franklin of Franklin Barbecue, confirmed the long simmering rumors that it was going to open a Houston location. They have leased a former church on 11th Street. They will be converting that into a new restaurant that is slated to open in the winter of 2021, by which I think that means approximately a year from now, right? January, February, 2021.
Wow.
Becky, let me Becky, let me start with you. Aaron Franklin's kind of your boy.
He's, I like to think we're BFFs, but, you know, I don't know.
let me just be real blunt. Have you talked to Aaron about this? I mean, what can you tell us? What insights can you share?
Well, I think it was the worst kept secret ever. Aaron told me a while ago, where he was going and all that, and I'm really, you know, there's every once in a while I'm good at keeping a secret.
Yeah, this was a poorly kept secret. Aaron was telling people about it.
Yeah,
certainly at Southern Smoke. Yeah, that's when I first started to hear some.
Well, I mean, you get really rumblings. You get really excited, and you want to shout it from the rooftop, and you know I get it, but I'm so excited.
You've eaten it, Laura.
I actually haven't eaten at Loro. I've had a lot of Loro food at different events. Most recently I did an event with, Tyson was there and John Gross was there with Loro for the Texas Metal Arts or something. Matthew McConaughey was supposed to be there. He wasn't.
Ooh. But hey. All right.
I know. I wanted to thank him for having me in a commercial, but you know, it was really reliant, but whatever. I digress. But so, you know, I've had a lot of bites. And then from Bram at different events, too. And it's always delicious.
Yeah, Matt. All right, Matt, let me bring you in on this. You've been to Loro.
I have been to Loro.
What do you think of Loro?
I'm a fan.
What about it stands out to you?
All of it.
The uniqueness of it.
I think, for people who haven't been there, right, they have an idea about the kind of barbecue that Franklin serves because it's been thoroughly imitated by dozens of other restaurants, and they have an idea about what Uchi serves because it's been here in the market since 2012.
Has it been here that long?
I promise.
Oh wow!
So yes. What is the experience like? What are the two or three memorable dishes that really stand out from your experience?
So I think is don't go expecting some hybrid of Uchi and Franklin's, because to me that's not what Loro is. So it's influenced by those flavors. I think they call it a Asian smokehouse.
They marry really they do. Well. Like the smokiness from
yes.
the meats.
So absolutely. The meats are the stars for me. There's some really fun dishes. Price point is nice. Space is particularly outside. It's just a good time. You can go with by yourself. You can go with, you know, small group, big group. It's interesting. It delivers on flavor. Again, the meat and the to me is the star. So,
all right, very good.
I imagine the hospitality to be amazing because you know, Uchi's amazing. I mean, well, both are amazing.
It just delivers on the experience. So.
Yeah, and I haven't had the chance to eat there. I certainly aspire to. But I do like that it's fast casual. I like that you don't have to stand in a huge long line to wait to order. You know, I like that it's indoor outdoor. It's a flexible dining space. I looked at the price points. It all seems pretty reasonable.
Yeah, and they're having some fun with it too. I mean, we had a brisket popcorn dish when we were there, and it's just like salty, sweet, and just finger food. It's like, all right, this is pretty good. Like, I'm a happy boy. I don't need a lot. Let's be honest. And anyone that knows me knows that I don't need very much if I'm in Tokyo.
All right. And So let me ask you one other thing about this, because I got some, and I will say this is a minority view, but there is a little bit of pushback on the number of restaurants opening in the Heights, the sense that the Heights is saturated, that there's too many businesses there. I definitely don't agree with that. I think people who express that view are clinging to a version of the Heights that may have existed, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, but doesn't really exist anymore, that there's been a lot of development both in the neighborhood and surrounding the neighborhood, so that there's a bigger population than used to exist there, and that people see the Heights now as a rival with Montrose as a destination for dining. But is there a point at which Are we reaching the point where there's too many restaurants in the Heights? Is it harder to compete?
Well, as someone who lives in Oak Forest, I welcome it, because you had to go all the way to Montrose. When I first moved here, what was that, 2007? You had to go to Montrose to go eat something good. And I don't want to drive to Montrose anymore. I'm old and like to be at home. Right?
Becky and I are in the old and cranky crowd.
Get off my lawn. You know, maybe like the neighborhoods are kind of pissed off with the parking. I know
traffic and the parking are the big,
you know,
complaints.
I remember when Snooze opened and a couple of foodie people that you saw their posts a lot were just pissed.
Oh, livid. Yeah, absolutely.
And you're like, hello, the world gets bigger every day. It's going to happen.
Right. Your house that you bought in, you know, 2000 is worth twice as much money now.
There you go. Thank you very
Congratulations.
Much.
Congratulations.
I know.
Yes.
I mean, you know, but as someone who lives close to the Heights, I welcome it. And I like the variety. I like that I can choose. I don't have to just go to, well, would we have Shade? Back then?
Yeah, you had Shade and maybe Glass Wall.
Oh, yeah, Glass Wall.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
we've come a long way. Stella Sola 10 years ago. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Was that 10 years ago? God, I'm old. There were so many baby faces in that kitchen.
Yes.
And look at them True all story. Now.
And it's they've amazing. Gone on to do they've gone on to do True beautiful story. Things.
I know. I'm so proud of those little youngins.
All right.
Well, I think it's the opposite. Well, the inverse, perhaps, is living in Montrose is now it's you know, I can go outside of Montrose a little bit, but I'm not going to do it as often as someone who lives in the Heights or maybe Oak Forest.
Yeah, I mean, I think Loro kind of existed in an independent sphere or a separate. This is a destination restaurant. It's owned by two of the most critically acclaimed chefs in Texas. You know, people from all over Houston are gonna want to try Loro, I think. And honestly, I would rather it be in the Heights. I mean, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, there's no way this restaurant opens in the Heights. It opens in the Galleria, maybe in Rice Village. You know, if you want to talk about
Maybe Washington.
But if you want to talk about traffic and ease of access and all that, like I think I would rather it. I think I'd rather it be in the Heights.
Bring it on.
Yeah.
All right.
Exactly.
Topic number two, International Smoke has closed. This was the restaurant. Celebrity chef Michael Mina from San Francisco partnered with lifestyle guru Aisha Curry to create a menu inspired by live fire cooking traditions from around the world. They hired EJ Miller, a talented local chef who'd worked at Salter Seafood Kitchen, Riel, a bunch of other places to run the thing. And they picked a prime location in City Center with a great patio. And it is gone in about a year and a half.
I bet those Rocket fans that bitched and moaned in the beginning are dancing up and down right now. Jerk faces.
Those NBA pedantics.
Matt, what do you think? I mean, are you surprised? I'm personally surprised that it closed so quickly. What was your reaction?
I think so. I feel like, you know, Houston does have that reputation a little bit of not being as friendly to outsiders, right? We've seen a number of concepts come in and close fairly quickly. I thought hiring EJ was a really strong move. The food there to me stood up. I would put it in the surprise category.
Becky, what about you? I mean, I know you probably never made it there.
No, it's too far. No, but I'm a big fan of EJ. And again, I've had a lot of EJ's food. And I think I kind of agree with Matt. Like, it's kind of hard to bring. It's kind of hard for those. Maybe it's we just support our own and want some outsiders.
Let me float a theory to you. I think it's even though when EJ was a guest on this podcast once and I asked him about the word barbecue and he said, oh, no, we call that the B word.
Yeah.
Because we don't want people to get confused about what we're doing and that it's different than Texas barbecue. So I wonder if they hadn't just built it as a seafood restaurant, you know, because they had a fried fish, they had a roasted fish, they had roasted oysters, they had all this like smoky grilled fish dishes. If they had pitched it as a seafood restaurant with some smoky elements, and stayed away from any reference to barbecue and not served those like not very good pork spare ribs, I just don't wonder if it would have. People would have approached it differently.
A different expectation walking in.
Right, because I think when you talk about barbecue in Texas, it's such a loaded, that term comes with so many expectations. And you can, if you're not serving, you know, sliced brisket, smoked sausage, you know, you're stuck.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that. You call something International Smoke. And my mind immediately goes to meat, not fish. So I could see that. But I just like to blame it on the Rocket fans. That's just mine.
I think that's fair. I mean, let's not lose sight of that.
Flaming Rockets. Let's not lose sight of
Flaming. They were given like 0-star Yelp reviews before it even opened.
Yelp cleaned some of that up. I mean,
I know, but still, it was still, it started, it had a bad juju out of the gate.
We're getting closer to the real issue.
What is the real issue in your opinion?
Y-E-L-P.
I do not think that Yelp reviews can make or break a restaurant. Maybe I'm being naive.
Well, I don't know that it's any one thing. I know that branding and expectations are important, but I think there's something also to momentum. And not to belabor the Rockets point, I think it's difficult when you come out of the gates without that type of momentum to sustain you. We've seen that in some other places recently, from out of town locations and concepts that are successful in other places and come here and don't have that momentum in the beginning and look for it and try different things and it doesn't happen.
And to be fair, outside of people who travel and know food, we have 4 million people in this city. How many of them know who Michael Mina is?
Right, but I think a lot of them know who Ayesha Curry is.
That's true.
I mean, maybe I'm being naive. Yeah, you're right. Michael Mina, I mean, it's not Thomas Keller, you know, but
right.
But he has a very good reputation.
They did, and they did a great job like teaming up with Hugo and like kind of getting someone with a lot of local popularity to try it. I mean, they did do a good job with that.
Yeah, and they did a lot of groundwork. I mean, Michael Mina came here for pop-ups. I remember one at Hugo's where they sold out and had a bunch of people in. And I thought, you know, I thought that was kind of the, well, Garden Grace just did a lot of that in the run-up to their opening where they did a series of dinners and events with local chefs to kind of introduce themselves to the market. I thought International Smoke did some of that. I thought they did it pretty well. But then also, they've, since they opened in Houston, they've opened 2 restaurants in Florida. They're working on a location in Vegas. You know, maybe this didn't have their full attention, right? Maybe making Houston successful wasn't as high a priority for them as it might have been for a smaller restaurant group with fewer locations.
I mean, I definitely fall victim to this, but you have on like social media, you have the food based part of Houston, right? And it's 10% of the 4 million people that live here. And you think, oh my God, 500 people like this photo, they're all going to come order it. And then 5 do, right? Because the other 450 don't live in Houston. But I think we see what we see on a daily basis on social media and in the news, because those are the things we're hyper-focused on. And we think, oh my God, this is amazing. This is going to be great. It's going to kill it. And then it turns out to be a dud because we didn't think about the other 3.5 million people that live in this city that might not know who Michael Mina is, might mistake International Smoke for barbecue. I think there's a lot of factors in that. We have to kind of open our eyes on how we market and brand ourselves, and maybe that was just it. Maybe they should have gone more seafood focused.
Well, I think it's a reminder that opening a restaurant is difficult. There's not there's not like 10 points. Like if you follow these 10 things, you're going to be successful. And it's usually not one single thing. I'm sad for EJ. I really enjoyed his cooking.
I love
EJ. He's a talented guy. I think he'll land on his feet. But that's... unfortunately,
he spent a lot. I mean, he went to San Francisco for a good month.
Yeah.
I mean, he put a lot of time and effort in. So,
yeah, maybe they'll snatch him up and take him to Vegas for the Vegas location.
He can't go to Vegas. He has to stay here. Sorry, EJ. I've grounded you.
All right. Let's move on. Topic number 3. The owners of Doris Metropolitan announced that they are opening a new modern Israeli restaurant called Hamsa. This will be opening in the former 5555 Morningside. It used to be a bar. They're gonna gut it and renovate it and give it a tree-lined or tree-shaded patio. Doc Holidays. That's what it used to be. The old Doc Holidays, which is where the first version of Pokéology opened a couple of 3 years ago.
Sure.
Sure.
Wait,
I mean,
so it was Doc Holidays, then it was Pokéology, yes. And now it's going to be the Israeli. Okay, I'm now on the same page.
All right, Matt. I know you've been to Doris Metropolitan. Becky, I feel like I know the answer to this. There's no way you've been to Doris Metropolitan.
I went to Trinity.
So there should be a segment on the show.
Where has
Becky been?
Yeah, where's Becky eating? It's a short list.
Well, we all know that when I open maps at leaving work, it tells me to go to Real.
That's fair.
Yeah.
I mean, no argument from me. All right. Matt, I think you're with me on this. Doris has been open for a couple of years now. I think it is one of the most creative and consistently satisfying steakhouses in Houston. And I am extremely excited about the prospect of a modern Israeli restaurant opening here.
It's, I would say excitement is pretty high. Yes.
I mean, from my perspective, Houston has not had a restaurant that kind of explores this cuisine. I mean, you know, the most prominently, especially for Houstonians, probably familiar with, if you go to New Orleans, you might have gone to Shaya or Sabra, which are the two restaurants founded by Alon Shaya, an Israeli chef. Or then in Philadelphia, Zahav is widely considered to be one of the best restaurants in the country. Michael Solomonoff has done very well with that, won multiple James Beard Awards. So I don't say that to say that I think Hamsa is going to earn national acclaim in the same way. But if we can get a restaurant of similar quality locally, and that the people behind Doris Metropolitan being Israeli, I am very excited. I have high expectations.
Well, I don't think we need to even get to that level. I mean, obviously, if we do, that's a huge, huge win for the city. But just a really good everyday Israeli eatery like that would be. It's in my humble opinion, it's something that's missing from the Houston dining scene.
Absolutely right.
That pita better be good.
Right. That pita better. Well. I mean, Doris has some of the best bread in Houston.
I know. That's why I've heard that 100 million times, and that's why I'll go.
Yeah.
Because I bet that pita is going to be good.
Yeah, I think that pita is going to be good. I think the hummus is going to be good. I think, you know, the kebabs and the vegetable dishes and all of those things will be. Again, I don't want to belabor the point, but I do think this will be a really nice addition coming in the summer.
And it's also a type of food that it's really sort of speaks to you when you eat it. It's clean, it's fresh, it's satisfying, it's different, and something that would be on the rotation, regular rotation.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially if the price point. You know, I asked Itai Ben Ali, who's one of the owners of Doris, about this, and he. You know, obviously the price point will be lower than Doris, which is, you know, a steakhouse serving dry-aged prime beef. So, you know, to the point that it's affordable, you know, this is the kind of place you could eat a couple times a month instead of a couple times a year.
I'm down.
True story.
I'll All right. go. I'll call Matt.
It's a date.
It's a date. Yeah.
And then real briefly, topic number four. I don't want to linger on this too long, but I do think it's worth noting that Richard Knight has left Atlas Diner at Bravery Chef Hall. Richard is a chef I've been following for a very long time, going back to Feast, the restaurant he opened in Montrose in the mid 2000s. They
2009,
got
2009,
is that when it opened?
Yeah,
I was at Catalan.
Okay.
I remember the first time I met them was there.
Somehow in my head I had it as 2007 or 8, but you.
It may have, if it did, it snuck into late 2008 because it won several awards for best new restaurant in 2009.
Whoa. Yeah. Oh, I mean, I remember when it won, you know, My Table Restaurant of the Year. I remember when they got a Beard semifinalist nomination. That menu with nose to tail cooking and farm, like local farm produce, and the idea that the menu changed a little bit every day, that based on availability, like if you saw a dish on a Tuesday, you had to go that night because it might not be around by Wednesday or Thursday.
Didn't Lyle work in that kitchen too?
Lyle worked in that kitchen. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, Lyle Bento.
I only remember that I was at Catalan because Richard and what was the other gentleman?
James Silk.
And his wife, Megan, came to eat at Catalan. And Richard told me my sticky toffee pudding was better than his mom's.
Wow.
I know. I was like, man, a British man told me that.
That might be the nicest thing anyone's ever said to you.
It might be.
Yeah. Well, I just said that we would go eat at
Hamsa.
So that's probably number second. Two now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. We're on a roll.
Don't forget about Roy.
Oh, and then Roy. Yeah. Roy gave me a compliment.
2A.
Yeah. Oh, 2A. Yes. Okay. All right. I'm sad.
So, yeah, no. So I talked to Richard a little bit. I heard about this. I went over to Bravery. I talked to Richard. And he said that, you know, the demands of day-to-day restaurant service are just, you know, he got married last year. He has a young daughter. He wants to spend time with his wife and his daughter. No argument for me about that. I'm going to miss knowing that I could have his food because I've been eating it. I was a feast, you know, I was a feast fan. I was a big advocate for Hunky Dory. Sad that didn't work out in the way that it was supposed to. And I thought Atlas was kind of, you know, an extension of some of the more casual stuff that he had done at Hunky Dory and kind of quirky and fun in its way and a compelling addition to Bravery Chef Hall. But I will miss knowing that I could go there and see him.
So Atlas will still be in the...
Yeah, Atlas is sticking around and Kat Lee is going to run that kitchen. And she's someone who's been around for a long time. She used to run the kitchen at Grand Prize.
Oh, yeah.
She was Anthony Callio's right hand at Pie Pizza when that opened. She worked on the line at Cultivare. She's super talented, hardworking. So I don't worry about Atlas under Kat's leadership. But this is just more like this is the end of Richard's kind of 10-plus year career in Houston restaurants. And it's just a little bit, you know, someone who's cooking I've enjoyed for a long time and someone whose presence I'm going to miss seeing on a regular basis.
Samesies.
I think that's fair.
Yeah.
All right. That does it for the news of the week. We'll be right back with our restaurants of the week. Stick around.
You're listening to What's Eric Eating?
So for our restaurants of the week, Matt and Becky, I've eaten at one establishment with each of you. Becky, let me start with you. Let's talk about Presley's Southern Good Eatery. This is a Southern fried kind of restaurant with a massive patio that opened right on the border of Shady Acres and Lazy Brook Timber Grove. Becky, let me just throw it to you. What did you think of Presley's?
You'll probably never see me there again. I think if you are a family with children and want to go hang out, dad wants to watch baseball or football and the wives want to get together and talk and the children can go play and eat chicken fingers, boom, nailed it. That's it.
Yeah, I had higher hopes for this place. I got a preview tasting before it opened that I thought was pretty good. Sadly, like your chicken tenders were dry.
Mm-hmm.
My chicken fried steak was bland. The fried pickles were good.
The French fries were good.
French fries were good. The fried pickles were good.
Yeah.
You know.
They do have a large selection of White Claw.
They have a large selection of White Claw. They have a big cocktail menu. They have a gigantic patio. I think I'm with you. I think this is more of a hangout spot. Very family friendly. Prices are reasonable. Not really the food destination. I mean, I love Southern fried comfort food. I was hoping for a little better from Presley's.
I'm right there with you.
Did somebody say fried pickles?
Yeah, they have fried pickles.
They have really good fried pickles.
They're pretty good. And the french fries are really good. But other than that, Eric was like, I knew we were in trouble when I go, how's your chicken fried steak? And he goes, it's fine.
This is, yeah. I've had,
I was like, yeah, we're done.
As my grandmother once said, she was the most proper, like formal New England type you can imagine. I've had better.
There you go. Boom. I had some chicken tenders from Whataburger last night, and they were really good.
You know where we didn't have chicken tenders last night?
Presley's.
Houston's.
We can't do that.
I have a huge rant about this that we don't have time for on this episode of the show. I'm going to save it.
Okay.
I will have the Houston's chicken finger rant on an upcoming podcast. Matt, I will say you and I had a more satisfying dining experience at Handy's Dozo.
Lucky guy.
The new Tamaki establishment from the owners of Kokoro at Bravery Chef Hall. This is located in the former Happy Fat space on 6th Street. Is it 6th Street at that point or is it White Oak?
I think it's White Oak.
I think it's White Oak.
All right. Matt, you're my expert on all things Japan. What did you think of our Tamaki experience?
You had me at Handy's, Daddy.
Excuse me, this is a family-friendly show.
I was speaking of food.
No, but how did you enjoy our dining experience?
They were very good.
Yeah, I think just from the crispy nori,
that toasted nori was game changer.
Right, the rice has the right like vinegar element. I thought the fish was seasoned well. I mean, the only thing is I don't know how many, like if I were hungry, I don't know how many I would have to eat to feel full.
Yeah, there's a couple things. I don't think that's what they're trying to do. That's, that's not the concept of that you're going to go there and, order
a dozen
a starter and, an entree and a dessert.
You can walk over to Cultivari when you're done.
You can walk over to Cultivari
and have a pizza or a bowl of black pepper spaghetti. I think that's that's the path to full.
I mean, that sounds pretty good.
Yeah, I saw our Matt friend, Matt Chow and John Yu on Instagram did that recently, and shout out to those guys. That's doing it. That's doing your White Oak two-step the right way.
That's the Handy two-step, Daddy.
They just need something sweet on that street, huh?
There used to be a gelato place, and it went away.
I know. So sad.
I thought they were very good. The flavor was particularly that spicy tuna was notably outstanding.
Spicy tuna was outstanding. The hamachi was very good. There was the only one that didn't really work for me was the crab. Didn't have enough crab.
Yeah. I think that there was a ratio issue there on the crab that was a little bit of a problem.
Right, but nothing about. I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I want to go back there, and I am looking forward to comparing it to Hondo, the other Tamaki restaurant that is opening on 11th Street this very week. So,
yes,
we'll have Food Fight Battle Heights Hand Roll coming up.
Correct. Not Hando. Hondo.
Hondo.
Got it.
Yes, as we learned when Jason and Daya and Manwin were on this very show a few weeks ago. And then real fast, I do want to note the opening of Jenny's Splendid Ice Cream, now open at 19th and Ashland.
Get it. Go get it.
In the Heights. Becky, you hosted a pop-up for Jenny's with founder Jenny Britton Bauer. Matt, you are a Jenny's super fan.
True story.
These are all facts.
Either one of you... explain to people who haven't tried Jenny's what makes that ice cream so good.
It's magical. It's just good. It's just solidly it's technically perfect and delicious.
Quality ingredients.
Great flavors.
Great flavors.
Right. Creamy texture.
Creamy texture.
Right. The flavors, even like the darkest chocolate.
Which is dairy free, by the way.
I didn't know that. I know the Texas sheet cake is dairy free.
Oh, maybe that's the one. No, I think the darkest chocolate one that she brought, because the sheet cake and the darkest chocolate, they're both dairy free, I think.
I mean,
I could be wrong, but Texas sheet cake for 100%, yes.
Right. So lots of dairy free options.
That cream puff. Oh, my God. I saw it on Instagram and wasn't anywhere near. I finally got to taste it.
I had gooey butter cake.
Oh, yeah.
Over the weekend.
I have not had that.
Wow.
There you go.
Well, I'm ordering enough to take a bath.
I mean, I had the peanut butter with the chocolate flakes in it, and it's just like the peanut butteriest. It's salty, like not salty, like too salty, but like salty in a good way. Very creamy, melts in your mouth. Chocolate, I mean, chocolate and peanut butter. That's a very favorite flavor combination for me.
That was my second scoop.
There's a lot of ice cream in the Heights right now. Between Sweet Bribery, Fat Cat, Cloud 10, Dolce Nev, there's more coming.
I love Dolce Nev.
There's more coming. Honey Child Sweet Creams is going to open at the MKT Heights development sometime next year. Aqua S from Chinatown is opening on Yale Street in the same strip center as La Vibra. But right now for me, I mean, as a scoop, like not because Jenny's doesn't do sundaes. They don't do milkshakes. They don't have cookies or brownies or any of that other stuff. But just as a scoop of ice cream.
They don't need all that.
It is very compelling.
They have a solid product. They don't need all the woo woo to go with it.
I get a woo woo?
it speaks for itself. Yeah.
It's very good.
Good.
Had a brief conversation when we were in there, just passing along a little insider knowledge. The pints that they have at Jenny's are not the same pints that you can get at Central Market. So if you're looking for Jenny's ice cream, go to Jenny's in the Heights.
What makes them different? Did they explain?
Yes, different distributor.
Somebody else makes it.
I think it's distributor. It's just fresh. It's a freshness issue. They can completely control that chain of command.
Got it.
So, and they have plenty there.
No shortage.
Yeah.
And two dozen different flavors in the dippers.
That's amazing.
Yeah. It's compelling.
Do it. Go.
Do it.
All right, Becky, before you get out of here, what's going on at Fluff Bake Bar?
So this weekend we have Robin Berwick from Double Trouble, and we're doing I cannot pronounce this whatsoever. I'm going to try Meli Kalikimaka, which is Merry Christmas in Hawaii.
Yeah. The song.
Yeah. Okay.
Meli Kalikimaka.
There you go. Thank you. So we're going to do,
I think he needs to say that a few more times.
I know, right? Three more times.
I don't think I can. I have to think about the song in my head.
There's gonna be spam, and there's pineapples coming straight from Hawaii. There's gonna be rum. There might be hot buttered rum. It's just gonna be delicious, and it'll be a great way to kick off the Christmas week. And then holiday orders, get them in by Sunday. Do it. We got lots of good stuff
by Sunday, people.
Pistachio pound cake. Derby pie, Stump de Noel.
Stump de Noel.
Yeah. I mean, come on. What is there not to love?
All right. Matt, thank you.
Thank you.
Becky, thank you.
Thank you.
I'll be right back with Michael Sandbrooks and Steve Breaker.
You're listening to What's Eric Eating?
I'm joined this week by two of the principals in Sandbrooks Management Company. It's the local restaurant group behind the Pit Room, 1751 CN Bar, Candente, and more. Gentlemen, let me introduce you individually so that people can hear your voices. Michael Sandbrooks, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks for having me.
Steve Breaker, thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you.
Gentlemen, I think the last time I had you on the show, Michael, you had just acquired the three former Cherry Pie Hospitality restaurants. It was about That's a year ago, Starfish Pie Pizza and Lee's Fried Chicken and Donuts. You've comprehensively reworked two of them, and you opened Candente, a Tex-Mex restaurant. So we have a lot to discuss. Why don't we start with 1751? Because, well, just chronologically, I think that that sort of makes sense. Talk to me a little bit about kind of the conception for the seafood restaurant, because I've be very honest with you. I've been working on my article about the best new restaurants of 2019. I have a spot for 1751 on it.
Nice.
And I was thinking about, like, it's not a Gulf Coast seafood restaurant. It's not like a generic, like, you know, kind of classic seafood restaurant. Like, it's kind of its own thing. So how do you describe what you're doing there with Chef J.D. Woodward?
Okay, so, well, that took a little bit. So the R&D process for 1751 was about 8 or 9 months, really, from conception to kind of realizing what we wanted to do and what we wanted to be. It was a lot of different conversations. And, you know, in the meantime, we had the advantage of operating Starfish, you know. So we had a full kitchen, we had a staff, and we had the chefs that came on board, and we were able to kind of play with dishes, get feedback, and kind of develop it over time. But the general idea is we didn't want to be locked in, like you said, to being a Gulf seafood restaurant. We wanted to go beyond that. There's so many other things that you can bring in from other parts of the world, other parts of the ocean. We didn't really want to be limited to just what we could get from the Gulf Coast. And then kind of drawing on everybody's kind of experiences that was involved, Steve being, you know, from Uchi, and, you know, JD having a background with a good raw program. We kind of wanted to combine all those things. So our general thought was we wanted to be a small plate seafood restaurant. So we wanted people to come in, be able to order 6, 7, 8 different small plates, and then maybe share an entree. And that was kind of the general format of the menu that we went with. I mean, Steve could probably speak more to kind of the food side, because he's been over there working directly with JD for the most part.
You know, from the outset, you know, just like Michael was saying, we didn't necessarily want to have like, oh, we are this. We wanted to be super flexible. Really, the one thing that we wanted to make sure was a standard was we were going to try to bring in absolutely positively the best product that we could find. So, you know, again, big nods to the, you know, the Gulf seafood movement. You know, God knows I worked for about 8 years over at Reef, and certainly have a lot of respect for that. But at the same time, for us to be able to bring in ultra ahi tuna from, you know, off of the Hawaiian coast, to fly in A5 from Japan, you know, these are all like really important things to us. We want to be able to expose people to as many of the wonderful things that the world has to offer and just treat them as simply as possible and try to respect what we're working with. And to Michael's point, we wanted a restaurant that could be flexible, that kind of cater to the people that want the traditional, oh, I want my appetizer, and then I want my entree, and then I want my dessert, and also cater to the kind of dining that I know that Michael and I really appreciate, which is I want to eat everything on the menu. Right. So
fire the menu.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, give me everything.
Fire on the menu. Just give me 5 minutes in between.
Right.
And so to be able to offer small plates and allow people to kind of, you know, taste the menu across the board, something that was really important to us.
Yeah.
And I think JD is such a solid choice to sort of execute that vision. You know, he worked for Brian Caswell at Stella Sola. He worked for Chris Shepherd at Underbelly. He worked with Lyle Bento at Southern Goods. So, you know, someone who's kind of very thorough in his approach, but is, you know, very good at kind of taking those different immigrant cuisines and kind of incorporating them into his own perspective. I mean, I like that I can get, you know, uni carbonara and chicken karage if I'm feeling a little more Asian, or you can get, you know, wood roasted Gulf oysters and redfish on the half shell. I mean, it's all there for you. And I just think it gives the restaurant, you know, a flexibility that you couldn't have done if you were, you know, if you were just like, you know, Michael, I know you came up kind of in the Good Company world, you know, if you had just tried to replicate Good Company seafood, you wouldn't be able to do some of those things.
No, I mean, and you're kind of locked into what you can do. And we didn't want to be locked into any one thing. But, you know, at the same time, trying to find a cohesive balance on the menu between all these different influences was a little difficult. And again, that's kind of what led us to kind of interesting small plates throughout the menu. And I mean, I can't speak enough about how talented and good JD's been for that concept, just from bringing him on to where he is now, just seeing the growth that he's had with the food and the staff. I mean, it's just completely streamlined, and I'm blown away every time he puts out a new dish. I mean, he's doing some really, really exciting stuff over there.
Well, and I don't want to belabor this point too strongly, but obviously when you opened the restaurant, Lyle Bento was your culinary director, and he's not with the company anymore. So, you know, for JD, I mean, it's, you know, what was it like for him? I mean, when he, you know, basically he had to step up.
Yeah, I mean, JD kind of was brought on as the executive chef for that location. You know, Lyle obviously was helping him out with the menu there and the presence there. And, you know, he had a lot of kind of say and influence on a few of the dishes that we put on the menu. But for the most part, since JD came on, it's kind of been JD's show. I mean, he's been running the staff. He's been doing the purchasing. He's had, you know, a lot of the innovative ideas, and he's kind of really delivered on kind of the concept that we went out to create. And so as far as stepping up, I mean, it wasn't a big transition for him because he was already in that role, you know?
All right. And then let's talk about the beverage pine. Cause you named the restaurant after the Gin Act of 1751, which I did not know was a thing until I got that press release explaining the name to me. But you know, you have, what, like 130 gins on the back bar?
Well, I think we're up to 146. David Manus will basically let me know if I got that number wrong. But, yeah, I think we're right around there.
Which we're going to slow down on that a little bit, I think. But, no.
Well, I mean, you've got to be hitting the approximately the limit of the number of gins available for sale in Texas
think,
at some point.
Right? Yeah, we're getting there. But yeah, the name was funny. It was we labored over that for like 3 months. We went several different names, and we kind of wanted something that was a little kind of speakeasy-ish, a little more subtle. And so, you know, 1751, yeah, it's a nod to the Gin Act that basically regulated the production of gin in London and kind of made it into a better product than it is today. And so when Steve and I kind of sat down at Starfish, one of the things that we were most impressed with was this gin program and this cocktail program that was basically been headed up by David Manus for the previous owners. And when we started thinking about what we were doing there, we just got really kind of fascinated by it and listening to David talk about all these different gins and the different styles. And so when we went through the renovation process, we built this huge, elaborate back bar. I think it holds like 600 bottles or something. Yeah. And because we really wanted that to be a focal point of the restaurant. So it's kind of we built a big community table and a big bar that's real comfortable, and you can come and talk to all the bartenders. It's a very interactive experience. And I think we have like 25 different cocktails on the list right now.
I believe so.
So the beverage side was a huge component to what we wanted to do. And we looked around Houston and we're like, we didn't really know who else was doing kind of gin focused cocktail bar. And we thought that there was kind of a big opportunity for that and a pretty exciting opportunity. So yeah, that was a big part of 1751 and, you know, who we wanted to be and what our identity wanted to be. So,
all right. So you're heading in, you're getting close to the year mark with 1751. I mean, how's it going?
It's going great. It's going really, really well. The Astros were terrible for fine dining. I'm sure that you've heard that from all.
I've heard that from multiple people.
All your people out there. But holiday season's great. We just rolled out a new holiday menu for cocktails. We rolled out some new seasonal dishes. And, you know, business has been great. I mean, we've gotten a good response from everybody, and we're starting to grow that regular client base, you know, a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. So we're starting to see the same faces come in over and over again. And that's kind of what it takes when you get to that point, you know, is that you kind of have consistent regular business coming in. And I think we're getting there.
All right. And then let's move on to Candente, which, you know, again, if I were ranking the best new restaurants solely by the frequency with which I have dined there, Candente would be my number one. I think part of that is that it's just physically, it's very close to where I live. And part of that is that a couple of my good friends are kind of obsessed with it. I think, you know, there's so much Tex-Mex in Houston, so much really good Tex-Mex in Houston. It can be, I think it's difficult to open a new restaurant and have anything sort of original to say about it. How did you kind of approach that challenge? Cause I think you've achieved something.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're right. So Houston is, I mean, it's a Tex-Mex town and, you know, we kind of talked about it and, you know, as far as there's different levels and they're just kind of different styles of Tex-Mex. You know, there's places you go for enchiladas and cheap street tacos. There's places you go for fajitas. When we looked at Tex-Mex, you know, I mean, everybody says there's so much Tex-Mex, but it's kind of like there's been, you know, three big players for the last 15 years, the El Tiempos, the Papacitos, the Lupe Tortillas, the Ninfas. And there hasn't really been any kind of new person coming into their side of the market of Tex-Mex. And that's kind of where we wanted to be. We want to try to get into that side of the market on Tex-Mex. So we kind of took the same approach that we did with the Pit Room. Yeah, there was a lot of good barbecue when we opened the Pit Room, but kind of went back to what our fundamentals were. It's we're going to buy the best meat we can. We're going to make everything from scratch, you know, and we're going to add a lot more higher quality items to the menu. So that was kind of our general idea moving into it. And then, of course, we wanted to influence with what we wanted it to be. So, you know, I have places where I go, like if I want beef fajitas, I'll go one place. If I want enchiladas, I'll go another place. If I want nachos, I go another place. So we wanted to try and be a place where you can get all those different things. You can get the combo plates, but you can also go for the fajitas and the add-ons, you know, and it's all really good quality under one roof. So that was kind of what we set out to do. And then we have a section of kind of grill specialties that is a little bit more unique Tex-Mex items, like our half chicken, our taco burrito de res, stuff like that, which not many of the other Tex-Mex places are doing. And then we have the barbecue component. So when we opened the Pit Room, obviously we had a little bit of a Tex-Mex influence in the barbecue. So that's kind of what we wanted to do. We wanted to do Tex-Mex with a little bit of barbecue influence. So you can get brisket enchiladas, you can get brisket tacos, brisket nachos, the whole thing.
Chopped brisket in your queso.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean,
exactly.
Nobody, right. There's some smoked elements in the campechana, I think.
Yep.
And the mussels that we do in the Jasper oven, you know, carry over that smoke. So yeah, we want to add like little hints of it. Certainly.
Yeah. Here and there, you know, throughout the menu. So even the octopus gets, you know, picked up in the Jasper. So it picks up the smoke for the campechana, a few other things like that on the menu.
Yeah, it speaks to kind of the comprehensive nature of your approach. I mean, you took over the old Cane Rosso space on Richmond, and you know, just you kind of rethought it. And I thought it was so smart that when Cane Rosso opened, the entrance to the restaurant was on the Richmond side, which meant you had to kind of walk halfway down the building to get in the front door,
right,
which for an office building is like a logical place to put the front door. But when you're coming from the side street, from Yoakum or from the garage, you know, you just want to come in. So you move the front door to make it just a little bit easier to get in the restaurant. And I just, like, it's such a no-brainer, right? It's like, well, why didn't they do that the first time?
That's kind of what we thought. I mean, honestly, we were walking the space with the architect, and that was really the first comment we had, is that the flow was off. So it was, you know, because you got to think about when you're driving in, just like you said, you're parking there, you want the easiest route to enter.
Right, and it's a long, skinny space, and so you just sort of orient the...
Yeah, you orient it, you know, with the main entrance, you know, at the head of the long, skinny space, instead of, you know, the main entrance walking in off the street, which I think was probably a big problem for them. It was just hard to get to, you know. But I mean, the general construction of the place was pretty good and easy. I mean, the permitting came out pretty quick. I mean, the hardest part was putting the new hood in for the wood burning grill that we put in. You know, we had troubles trying to design that and get that through a two-story garage and all that stuff. And but luckily we made it through. We're still working on a few things, but I think it all overall it came out pretty good.
Well, yeah, I do have to ask you about one of the things I think you're still working on, which is it can get a little bit warm in that room sometimes.
Yeah. So actually, I do want to address that. So it hasn't been. Everyone kind of is going, well, why don't you just fix the AC? And
well, I'm sure it's not that simple. Yeah. I'm sure you know that it's a problem.
Yeah.
But I did want to give you the chance to sort of tell people what you're doing about it.
I appreciate that. So I have an engineer working on it with me now, and I've gone through about 6 or 7 AC people that have come out and looked at it, and you know, nobody's really been able to help. It's these Samsung smart units that are programmed with this chip that we can't access and turn on and off. So essentially we're going to have to rip out and redo all of the HVAC. So it's going to mean closure time. It's going to mean a big ticket project. And, you know, so it hasn't been as easy to schedule that or get somebody to really come in and investigate the current equipment that we have and really, you know, give us a direction on how to fix it. They've just kind of looked at it, said it's complicated, charge us for a trip fee, and then don't do anything about it. So it's been a really difficult road.
Yeah. So if I could give anybody out there a piece of advice, is never buy any equipment, smart equipment, that's smarter than anybody that's supposed to service it.
Right. Yeah. So it's been a problem, but we're going to get it fixed. And then, you know, people have mentioned that it's smoky. It's because there's not enough pressure balance in the dining room from the AC. So it's not pressurizing enough. So the smoke's coming out from the kitchen. But as soon as we fix the AC, all that stuff will be, it'll be normal. It won't be smoky in there. It won't smell like a barbecue restaurant. It'll be perfectly comfortable for everybody. And we are going to fix it soon.
Well, and I'm sure you don't want to close during the holiday season.
Right.
And you probably don't want to close until because when I drive past it, this has been a really busy place. I mean, whatever visibility problems Conte Rosso had, you figured out how to overcome.
It's been busy. It's only getting busier too. And so it just makes it really, really hard. So we got to find people to come out and work on it, you know, at midnight and work on it overnight and stuff so that we can minimize how often we can close. And honestly, I don't want to close. I mean, and once you close, you know, it's hard to get people to come back if they were going to try and dine with you and they show up and see that your restaurant's closed, then they might not ever come back. So it's a tough balance of how to weigh the problems and how to fix the issues.
I will say I've gotten, you know, a little bit, you know, the staff gets it though. Like they keep the frozen margaritas coming. They keep the tea refills right. on lock. Like they get it.
Yeah.
And just, I mean, you know, picking a favorite dish. I mean, like I'll never say no to an order of beef fajitas or a cheese enchiladas. But the carnitas were the big revelation for me.
Yeah. So the carnitas actually came from our sausage making process. We cube up the pork and then we actually cure it for 2 days. So we add the salt, the seasoning and all that. So we cure it for 2 days and then we render it in bacon fat, a little bit of a few other things. And so when we pick it up, we drop it in the fryer, it still holds all that moisture and that flavor. So I think that's the big difference, is the process of curing it and then, you know, keeping all that flavor in there. But yeah, carnitas are one of my favorite things to eat there too. Yeah.
All right. So let's move on to Pie Pizza. Cause you announced a new name, right? I think
I did.
Was it Dubro or,
Dobros?
Dobros.
Dobros. Pizza and sandwich.
What's the status of that? I mean, cause that would seem to be sort of the next process.
It's next in the process. I can tell you taking over or trying to do 4 restaurants in a year and a half has not been easy. They all kind of take time and, you know, it seems like it's about time for that one to come open with a new brand and a new name. We have the sign made. We have the branding done. we haven't really gotten, just to be honest, we haven't gotten around to the menu development yet. I mean, and it's just been a time thing. We're all kind of focused on 1751. Well, first we did kind of the Sam's Food, and then we're really focused on 1751. And then Candente took 8 months of menu development, branding, and build out. And it was just it was a lot of effort. And then, you know, once it got open, we had a staff of 75 people that we got to manage, we got to train, we got to put systems in place. And that we just haven't had enough time to put our attention on it, to be honest. So, you know, soon we're going to work on it, and we'll see what happens.
I heard rumblings once that you were contemplating Chicago style deep dish. Is that still something you kind of want to put your spin on?
I would love to. I think it, and if I'm just thinking around town, we don't really have much Chicago style deep dish. So, I mean, I always like to think about what can you offer a market that's missing. And, you know, I know that when I go to Chicago, that's one of my favorite things to do is eat, you know, Chicago style deep dish. We want to do the
spicy Italian beef sandwiches, my all-time favorite food,
and, you know, all that stuff. So I mean, the food's great, but again, it's just going to take time to figure out how to produce it, how to make it, how to make it right, and how to make it good. And just haven't put the effort into it yet.
Well, yeah, that does kind of open up a larger question. I mean, you converted one restaurant, you opened two more this year. How do you kind of manage the growth? Because, you know, certainly the recent history of Houston restaurants is littered with companies that flew too close to the sun, shall we say, when it came to their ambitions.
Sure. So, yes. I mean, the biggest thing that we've been trying to do is grow our infrastructure to kind of handle the expansion, which is mostly at the office and upper management level. And so that's really what we've been busy with, the accounting side, all the boring stuff that's not fun to talk about. But I mean, so we've just been trying to get all that stuff organized to be able to handle, you know, 5 units and, you know, 200 employees and, you know, all the different issues that come from that. So that's kind of why, you know, whereas me and Steve like to be in the restaurants, we've had to learn a whole new different role of
control freaks.
Yeah. Being out of the restaurants and trying to make, you know, systems and stuff from a distance work in the restaurant. So it's definitely been a weird learning process, and it's a tough transition, but we're almost out of it. We're almost through it. And I think it's going to be pretty good over the next couple of years, as long as we don't try and open up any more restaurants.
Well, so like, what's like the biggest thing you learned, or what was the hardest thing to let go of?
Hardest thing to let go of is being there every day, and just that how do I explain it? It's that feeling that you have to be at the restaurant for every busy service, and then it's giving up that control to your other managers and finding managers that you trust to run things that you want them to. I mean, what would you say?
No, I mean, it's that. I mean, you kind of like equate it to being a parent in a way. There's that separation anxiety, you know, after you've worked in the restaurant and you've R&D and you're spending 12 hours a day every day, and, you know, you're working for a month and a half, and then you're like, crap, I just can't keep doing this. I've got to take a day off. And then you sit at home just going, oh my God, what's going on? What's going on? Why isn't anybody texting me? What's that person doing at that table? How is
everything? Right. You're watching cameras on your phone, like, yeah. Oh my God, that guy needs a water refill.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Right. And you know, it's still one of those things where, you know, Fridays and Saturdays, I'll be expoing over at Candente. I run into the office, answer a few emails, and do whatever paperwork I need to do. And then I hop over to 1751. And, you know, it's not like those guys need me to make that place operate. It's just, I just feel better when I'm there.
Yeah, I mean, it's just being there. You have to be there to, you know, make sure that the standards are being upheld. And it's just, you can't be everywhere at once. So,
yeah. But, you know, I don't even know how to answer the question you asked, but I don't know if we've learned all the lessons we need to learn yet. There's a bunch of little ones, like don't assume your AC is going to work, even though you've got the proper tonnage. And,
right.
You know, it's just take nothing for granted.
But I assume you do want to grow. I mean, just experiencing Candente and kind of seeing the path of other Tex-Mex restaurants in Houston, that's the one that feels like it has legs to me.
Yes, us too. I mean, you know, the pit room, I don't think can be recreated. It's, you know, it's got location and the bar next to it and the big patio. And, you know, 1751 is kind of our high-end flagship. It's not something that you want to recreate. You want that to be kind of a destination. Candente, when we looked at Candente, we think that that's got, I think that can translate to several different neighborhoods within the Loop and, you know, maybe potentially beyond that one day, you know. And it's... I think it would be the concept that we would choose to expand if possible, you know, if the right opportunity came along.
So if I said there'll be three Candentes in Houston 5 years from now, does that sounds about right to you?
Well, I sure hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I sure hope so. Yeah, if all goes well, that would be a good goal of ours. Yeah.
And then do you have other concepts in mind, or are you kind of content with what you've got right now?
Yes, he does. we probably won't go into them, but yeah.
No, I have.
It's a constant conversation.
Yeah. I have two or three left that I
want to
do.
Just two or three.
Two or three.
You have a burger? Is one of them a burger place?
No, burger place.
I'm too scared to get into the burger game, but the sandwich game. I want to get into the sandwich game, like casual deli, like, you know, big sandwiches, bunch of different sides. I want to redo an old San Francisco steakhouse, bring that back.
I don't know that you can have a woman on a swing in front of the restaurant in 2020. I don't think that's politically correct.
Yeah. The woman on the swing was one thing, but the table cheese that stayed there from party to party, I think was probably the most frightening thing to me, but
yeah, that's probably not up to health code anymore.
Yeah. No. Yeah. So there's always things floating around in your head, you know. But, you know, I think that our focus is going to be running what we have, getting everything streamlined, finding the right staff to make sure that the experiences are consistent and perfect every time. And then, you know, we'll see how it goes from there. But, I mean, our short-term focus is streamlining what we got and what we did over the last year and a half.
Very good. I mean, that really brings me to the end of my questions, unless you have something that I haven't asked you about that you want to address.
Lord, I can't think of anything.
Not that I can think of, no. Uh-uh.
All right, well, I know you were here and you went through the lightning round with me, but I mean, what the hell? Can we do it again? Do you mind?
Sure, I'll try to... change my answer.
I'll try to ask you a couple of different questions. We'll compromise.
Yeah.
We'll compromise somewhere along the way. Michael, let me start with you. What's your favorite cookbook?
Ooh, favorite cookbook. I always forget the name. It's the it's the big textbook one. It's like The Science of Cooking from that Kinji guy. Can't remember the name.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
It goes into the specific detail of, you know, he goes through like boiling an egg and goes through 20 different recipes.
Isn't it the Food Lab?
Kinji
Lopez Alt.
Food Lab has been my favorite cookbook. I loved reading that because it goes into that technical detail that a lot of cookbooks don't.
Steve, how about you?
You know, I really enjoyed reading that Momofuku cookbook, David Chang's cookbook. It was actually it was a really fun read. I really enjoyed that one. And there's another one, too, that I just can't recall off the top of my head. But of course, you know, just the pictures in the Modernist cookbook are just a blast. So that was always fun.
Right.
All right. Instead of asking you what the first band you ever saw in concert was, let me ask you, what's the most recent concert you've seen?
The Melvins. Awesome show. Amazing show. Yeah. Saw it Warehouse Live. Can't beat a Melvins show.
I got to be honest, I'm not into going to concerts, so I haven't been to a concert in probably 15 years, so I can't even remember.
Not even like the rodeo?
Oh, I did go see John Legend at the rodeo, I think, like 4 or 5 years
ago. All right, close enough. I'll take that.
my first concert was Ann Murray at the rodeo when I was a small child. So it started with Ann Murray and ended with the Melvins.
Very nice. All right, so instead of asking you who your favorite Houston sports figure, past or present, is, let me ask you, who's your favorite current Texan?
Ooh, favorite current Texan.
J.J. Watt.
I mean, it's hard to distinguish between Probably DeAndre Hopkins, I think.
Yeah, Hop seems like a good hand.
Yeah, probably DeAndre Hopkins. I mean, J.J. Watt's the obvious town favorite, but...
Wow. Shots fired. Okay.
You know, but as far as someone who's always going to do something exciting, probably DeAndre Hopkins.
All right.
I'm going to change my name to to Whitney Merciless then. How's that? Yeah. That's obvious for you?
Yeah.
All right. Instead of asking you for your... for your fast food guilty pleasure, let me ask you, what's your favorite restaurant in Chinatown?
Fufu. I absolutely adore the cumin lamb. Amazing. Amazing. Great dish. One of my favorites.
I think it's Fufu's great. I think it's Hai Chang probably. I think it's I got the Dungeness crab there that they did with the curry. I still think about it.
Oh, yeah, that stir-fried lobster dish?
Oh, my God. Yeah, we got that, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that place.
That's strong.
And then either that or the crawfish place. I can't remember the name of it. Right,
crawfish now, noodle?
No, the other one.
Oh, okay.
Wild Cajun?
No.
Crawfish and beignets. There's...
This makes for great radio.
Yeah, I know. Sorry. Sorry. We'll move on.
and then finally... Since you're working on a pizza place, what's your go-to pizza order? What are your favorite toppings?
Literally everything. Add jalapenos. Just no fruit, no pineapple.
So I try to go basic. I do like two toppings at the most. Either like pepperoni and mushroom, or I like Canadian bacon and black olive.
All right, give us the websites for Candente and 1751. How's that?
Okay, it's CandenteHTX.com, and then the 1751 is 1751Houston.com, and then we've got the PitRoomBBQ.com.
All right, Michael, Steve, thanks for being here.
Well, thanks a lot. Thanks for having us.
All right, you can follow me on Instagram at Eric Sandler. Keep it locked on CultureMap.com for all the latest Houston bar and restaurant news. Thanks so much for listening. I'll be back next week.